Is your bedside table looking a little bereft? Do you need something new to read? Well, I'm Claire Nichols, and I'm here with another bonus episode of The Hub on Books to introduce you to a new Australian writer and maybe your new favourite book. Sarah Lestrange has had her nose buried in our stack of debut novels, finding you the very best new authors to read. Who have you spoken to this time, Sarah?
I've spoken to Robert Lukens. He's a Melbourne-based writer, but he grew up in the Sunshine State, so I feel I've got a special connection with him, being a fellow Queenslander.
Oh, you guys can stick together. So we're expecting a kind of sun-baked novel from him then?
No, quite the opposite. His novel is full of snow. The Everlasting Sunday is set in 1962 England during what was known as the Big Freeze. It was really, really cold, so cold that Premier League football was cancelled. Apparently this is very shocking. But the era really actually isn't so important to your reading of this novel. What's important is the atmosphere created by the extreme cold.
So what happens in this story?
It's about 17-year-old Radford who's been sent away to a boarding house known as the Manor. It's for troubled boys, and it's about his relationship with fellow troublemakers in this claustrophobic setting made more poignant and also unsettling by this blanket of snow that covers everything.
It really is an unexpected choice of setting for a Queenslander, but I'm really interested. I'd love to hear some of it.
Well, lucky for you, Claire, here's Robert with a reading from The Everlasting Sunday.
The boys stood in wonder, for above them the sky was breaking apart. It seemed to Radford exactly how a mirage might present itself. The starlings had lifted from their roost and swarmed into a molten object which oscillated above the horizon, making impossible shapes. They were a snake, a heart, a firework. The flock breathed with a lone purpose, and it was this unity that struck him, that all these beaks and breakable wings could come so close to disaster yet make a song so sweet. It made its way into his pulse, rising and falling, as the colony moved closer or away. "Seen this before?" he said, as the formation turned into a long arrowhead and aimed itself at the setting sun. There were a few shaking heads. "Mad. Mad." "I've seen it," West said. His voice had softened. "Years ago, my parents in Devon. My father used to take us with his caravan to Slapton Lay and we'd go for these awful walks." "What is it?" "It's called a murmuration." West ran his hands through his hair. "A man at the park told us. I haven't thought of that word since I was 8. I made him spell it out. How on earth has that stayed in my head?" They stood as silhouettes in the silver distance, and the birds continued, unaware.
Well, a murmuration. I've learned a new word today. It strikes me as a very thoughtful book and so beautifully read there as well. How did Robert Lukens come to write this?
Well, Claire, it was a seriously torturous path.
I grew up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, and my parents are resolutely British and my brother and sister are British. And when I was growing up, looking through my family photo albums, there were photos of my father riding a sled down the roof of his house and my grandfather shoveling the car out trying to get to work. And I used to ask about this, and this was the Big Freeze. And when you grow up on top of Budgerum Mountain in your fluoro board shorts and you're getting told these stories about the milk bottles freezing on the doorstep and not going to school for 2 months, these leave an impression with you. And so when I came to write this novel after many, many years of procrastinating on the task of writing a first novel by writing endless other novel-length things that weren't novels.
Like what?
Well, this is one of my strategies I think I worked out at some point. So I was avoiding the task of writing my first novel by writing novels. So from about the age of 16, somewhere along the line I adopted a mixture of a romantic and a puritanical approach to writing. So writing was this thing that had to be done by myself. It had to be done in isolation, and for some reason it had to be hard. As the years went on and on, I made things more and more difficult for myself, and I was writing exercises. I was convincing myself that I was teaching myself how to write. So every year I would write a novel. But each novel was an exercise in some way. So I would set myself a challenge. I would set myself a task and try and write my way out of it. Can I write a whole novel that's set in a room with no furniture and no characters and it's written in the second person? The answer to that question is
no.
The answer is yes, but it's a terrible novel.
and no one will ever read it.
And no one ever did. So I would write these things every year, and I did this every year.
How many non-novels did you write?
We could crunch the numbers on that.
Yes, but please.
I wrote one every year since I was 17. I don't know because, of course, in the intervening years, there were various moments where I'd have great moments of melodrama or I would destroy them or I would delete the computer. And sometimes I would set – and part of the challenge sometimes too was I would set myself the task of writing a novel, and the second it was finished and I was happy with it, I would just delete the file. And again, it was this childish, romantic, puritanical approach to writing. And at the time, I thought I was toughening myself up and I thought I was teaching myself how to write. And I think along the way, I did.
Sure, you must have.
In some respects. But also, I was just being gutless. I was avoiding the task of writing that first novel. Because what do you do if you've constructed your entire personality around the idea that you're a writer, which is something I did since I was my entire life? What do you do if that's who you are and then you write that novel and you can't do it? What if it stinks? And it wasn't even about some kind of perception outside of myself. It was just, what do I do psychically? How does my brain compute that? So I realize now I was busying myself by writing these what were millions of words of things that were like novels.
So how did you come to write this book, yeah. Everlasting Sunday?
So I think just the levee broke at some point, and I got to the point where I just realized that I'd just been practicing, and I never turned up to the exam. And I just thought, and also I'd been building up a quite negative approach to writing. Writing was this pressure cooker, quite horrible experience where I was sort of whipping my own back writing these things. For what purpose? And I was getting further and further and further away from anything that felt like a real voice or what I was trying to do. So one day I just set myself the real challenge, which was just to go to a blank page and see where I am in the world, see what kind of writer I've become, see what kind of person I've become. And so I just went to a blank page and I let, for the first time, instead of these rules and these confining things and these quite negative chips on my shoulder, I just let all that go and I just thought, where does my mind want to take me? And it took me to this house, which is a real house I knew.
Okay, I definitely want to know more about that house. But I am just coming to terms with the fact that he has written a novel, or a non-novel, as you called it, every year since he was 17. That's extraordinary.
I know, it's really hard to comprehend, especially that after all of those novels, it's only this one now that's being called the debut novel. And what's really interesting is that the reason he chose to set the story in a manor in Chile, England, it all comes down to his own experience as a postman in Shropshire, England, for a year.
The last delivery each day was 3 miles out of town to this great, impossible manor house at the top of the hill emerging through the fog, but it was an abandoned house. And it was such a moment of, so walking up those stone steps to deliver that mail each morning was such a concentrated and beautiful but terrifying moment and a lonely moment. Like, what was this Sunshine Coast kid doing wandering around the Shropshire Hills? And so my mind went to that house. I wanted to go in that house. I wanted to build a world around that. And I went to that winter that I heard about so much growing up, and I thought so much about the concentration of that feeling, and I wanted to build that concentration and the atmosphere. And it really was a matter of sitting down and opening the door to that house and just seeing what was inside.
Oh, and there were some troubled boys inside. And I guess we know stories of English boarding schools, the hazing that goes on, the hijinks, the neglect of the emotional needs of the children. What did you want to add? It seems like an old-fashioned topic to take on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of what interests me about writing, is discovering what I'm interested in seeing it evolve on the page. And when you go to a blank page, one of the things that can happen is that you can go to really unexpected places. You can end up in places you didn't know you were interested in. And you can also go to places you're very familiar with, because you just resort to those things. And I think what I've ended up here is a novel that that strays between those two worlds. And so you do have, you have archetypes there. This is in some ways a classic British boarding school story, but it's also the story of a house full of very intensely troubled people, and it's a pressure cooker environment, and it's explosive in lots of ways. So it's a place of comfort, but it's a place of danger as well. And it always, there's that feeling around each corner that something terrible might happen, and terrible things do happen. So, and this is just, so I just explored that world, and it was that idea of exploring something beautiful and something scary at the same time. And I just worked my way through that world and reported what I saw. And this is my report.
So we meet Radford to begin with. He is the central character of the novel. He's 17. He's been sent to the manor. We don't know why. He's done something terrible, probably. And then we see the manor through his eyes and see the boys through his eyes. And he's not really sure about his place there. But it becomes his home, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It becomes a place of sanctuary, but it also comes a place of him, again, exploring these beautiful and scary things. And it becomes, this house becomes a place that, if nothing else, it's that frozen moment. And as I talked about, these people came from dark places and they're probably going to go to difficult lives. And if nothing else, this house and this winter and this story represents a frozen moment in time where they can exist. And maybe just that moment of peace and calm is something they can carry with them the rest of their lives. And so this winter these boys exist in is just a place where they can find out who they are and how they work up against other people. And I think Radford is trying to discover what this place is, whether it is a place of peace and calm and respite or whether it is a dangerous place. And
because unlike our common images of English boarding schools where there's a disciplinarian, there's lots of rules, there's yes sir, no sir, in this place, it's anarchic. The person at the helm is called Teddy. You know, he's not Mr. He's not Sir. He's Teddy. And at times he participates in the boys' hijinks, and at times he stands back. He really is an interesting figure in this novel, but he's not a teddy bear.
No, and there are archetypes that exist in this story, but something happens in the writing that in some way poisons a lot of these archetypal characters. And Teddy is an interesting one, and I'm interested in this idea of, I think sometimes we're attracted to the idea of healing and helping other people in some ways to heal and help ourselves. And the boundaries between the carer and the cared for is a really interesting place for me.
He's always telling the boys that their responsibility is to look after each other.
Yeah. And as the story goes on, that line between who's looking after who and how these kind of power dynamics work within the house is that foggy atmosphere that sort of is enveloping this entire house. And so I'm discovering this story as I go on too. And part of the reason for writing this story was to work out how I feel about some of these things. And I change my mind every day about whether how I feel about some of the things that happen in this story, and especially Teddy's approach to this house, because I've had people approach me reading this, some people telling me how much they love Teddy and how much they care for him and what he did. And I've had people absolutely tear me to shreds on it, saying this is totally irresponsible what he's done. And all I can say about Teddy is that he tried his best, he meant well, and that's about all he can hope to do.
So he tells Radford a story about a historically significant tree, but Radford doesn't really know how to interpret it. What is that story?
Yeah, it's the story of the Royal Oak. So it's, again, one of these kind of archetypal stories, the guardian of the house taking the lad out to the hill and looking out on the horizon and telling this story about, a historical story about the Royal Oak, which was a tree that shielded the King of England who was on the run from during the interregnum. But again, we learn through this story that the story is built on a falsehood. So this tree, I don't want to give too much away, but the story is false. And I guess it's this idea of Teddy is trying to, in some ways, in this safe environment, teach these boys about self-reliance and self-resilience and also maybe about trust. And Teddy, who should be the most trustworthy figure in this story, he's not always trustworthy because he's a human being and he's a very flawed individual in the same way they all are. And I think he's trying to honour them by being honest to them by deceiving them. So it's this strange kind of swirling thing around authority and trust.
Yeah, so we see the stories of Radford and West, Foster and Brass. These are the names that are floating around. We know there must be other boys, but these are the ones we've focused on. But potentially you could have focused on any of them.
Yeah, and it's interesting you use the word focus. I thought so much about the idea of focus in this story. I feel like a floating, my head is a floating camera in this world, and it really was this idea. And this is how I experience life. I feel like we know each other's stories, where our stories intersect, and we know the parts of each other that the other person chooses to divulge and not. And you always have this feeling that there's these other worlds going on outside of your reach. And so part of me telling this story was like a camera pulling focus on certain characters. And we don't get everything from everyone in our life. I didn't want to have those moments where every character finally broke down and spilled the beans on all the reasons why they are how they are, because that doesn't feel real to me. And so we have unanswered questions, and we have answered questions, and we have insights, and we have blurry parts, and this is just what life is to me. And so I wanted to try and capture some of that on the page, and especially some of that sense of being a 17-year-old, and in some ways we've all at a certain age been plunged into environments where we're surrounded by strangers and we don't know the rules and we don't know the customs, and just trying to find our way through that world and try and pull focus. I tried to capture some of the sense of that with Radford.
What is the everlasting Sunday?
It's that idea of, I don't know if you had this, but when I was growing up, there was never a moment more potent and more a sense of foreboding than about 5 o'clock on a Sunday, because it was that even though Sunday should be that day of rest, it should be the most peaceful day of the week. When you're growing up, it's that second day of the weekend. Maybe you haven't got soccer that day, and it should be the calmest day, but it's forever poisoned by the promise of what's to come. So Monday's coming. We've all got to go to work. We've all got to go to school. And it was this idea of this house too. So this winter in this house for these boys, it is perhaps that Sunday, because the reality is these people aren't going to have miraculous moments where their lives are transformed. They're probably going to move into difficult adulthoods. And maybe this house just becomes an everlasting Sunday for these boys.
Oh, it sounds great. The Everlasting Sunday by Robert Lukens. It's published by...
It's a UQP book.
Thanks, Sarah, for this introduction to the book. And thanks to you, our very awesome podcast listeners, for tuning in to this special episode.
And if you haven't already, why don't you subscribe to the podcast? Because there really is something new for you each week.
And while we're asking for favours, please do leave us a rating and a review. It really does help other people to find the podcast. I'm Claire Nichols. Talk to you again on Tuesday. All in one.